Vienna, there's been a lot of activity up and down. I don't know, it's a very busy morning today. Everybody's up and down. I can't see what they are doing, but they're up and down. Oh, it's the last day. Shanaz is saying it's the last day and people are excited about the end of the year. Okay. Well, I'm not going to down their morals. But at least we've got some business of the day where we'll finish. His animal skin looks very sad. He doesn't look very happy.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Anyway, everybody's welcome. Thank you very much for coming. There is one of our delegates from delegations of the department who is... Oh, there is something. One of us here. Trying to excuse himself. I think therefore the program is going to continue as planned because he's already here. I had been told that you are going to join us a bit late. So, welcome. The agenda for today, as you might have seen in the list, we have to consider and approve the short list of candidates for the HSRC board. I think members might have received the notice that there are vacancies that need to be filled, and there are four shortlisted names that need to be approved by the committee. And the chief operations officer is going to lead us in that, and then we will then have to approve that. And then after that, we will have the DDG of International Operations of the department, who is going to brief us in relation to preparation of the upcoming conference on climate change, and the committee is intended international trip to South Korea and China, but I guess we are no longer going to consider China for some logistical reasons. And then finally the committee matters, which include the adoption of the outstanding minutes, consideration of the committee program, as well as discussion, if at all there are any areas or concerns or inputs to be raised about our international study talk. So that's the program for today. To end our parliamentary program for this year. Without wasting any time, I don't think we need to even introduce ourselves, because I think we have only two people that we know from the department, and they also know us. I only don't know two people here, the two ladies. That lady and that lady, they are very beautiful, but we don't know them. Unfortunate. Eh? So let them introduce themselves to us. That's all that we need. Hey, all the ladies there, they are beautiful, but these ones we do not know are even more beautiful. Let them tell us. Are you modeling?
Not at my age. I've been covering meetings for 3 years now.
Oh. In
the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Oh.
And we cover different committee meetings every day. So my name is Kirsten Sidney, and I'm covering the meeting for today.
Oh, okay. Sorry. sorry that I could not recognize you. Maybe you did a different makeup today. All right.
Good morning. Oh, my name is Ellen Lewan. I'm from the office of the
Oh, she's with you?
She's with me.
Oh, she's the new one, because I've never seen her before.
She's in training.
Oh, she's in training. Oh, you see, that's very important, therefore. I'll ask you the fact that she's a very cold committee. We don't even worry about her new presence. Okay, thank you very much. I think I will give it to Mr. Mavuso to then later support the short list of candidates.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Chair, in July 2009, the committee approved a shortlist of 17 names, which the minister was to consider appointing the board of the HSRC. And then the minister in September received the concurrence from cabinet to appoint 10 of those 17 names. But subsequent to that, Professor Zin and Mr. Masobe couldn't take up their positions. So they had to be replaced from the list of the approved names. And later, Dr. Naidu, who was part of the board that was approved by cabinet, was later appointed by HSRC as an employee, therefore had to be replaced. So we then recommended from the list that was approved by this committee that Dr. Botale Tema and Professor Pile must replace both Professor Zin and Dr. Naidu. Mr. Masobe, who didn't take up his position, was not replaced because I think the number of the members currently in the board was sufficient. But the challenge that we had at the time was that there was no candidate of the 17 names who met the criteria of Section 5B of the Act, which required that one of the board members should have financial expertise. So in that regard, then we then went out to source the what call names of individuals who meet that particular criteria, because we didn't have, when we issued the call for what call for members of the board in 2009, we did not get candidates who met that criteria. So in front of this committee today, there are two names that are presented for consideration by the committee to be included in the pool of names that we could tap on should we have vacancies. So in this regard, we have Mr. Harold Matabate, who is a financial expert, and also we also have Professor Enrico Juliana, who is also a director of finance at the University of Cape Town. So those are the two names that would like to present the committee who meet the category of Section 5 in relation to the expertise, financial expertise that we need for the board to be able to fulfill its responsibility. The second one relates to the very same section where we are required to have a member who must be a distinguished representative of the social science community in the rest of the continent. In that regard, when the board was approved in 2009 by this committee, there were two names, which was Professor Sweyer, and the other person was Mr. Somaseku, who met that particular criteria. Mr. Professor Sweyer took up his position as a representative, on the board who represents the social science community, and then he has since resigned. So Mr. Somaseku is one of those who are available, but the minister has recommended that we add two additional names. If the committee approves, then the minister will select from the three names the person who will be able to fit that particular category. In this regard, we have Dr. Ebrima Sal, who is an experienced individual in social and political science research, and currently is with the innovative sector at the Council for Development of Social Science Research in Dakar, Senegal. We also have Professor Adebayo Olukoshi, who is a distinguished social researcher in the continent. He's currently the director at the United Nations African Institute for Economic Development and Planning. And so he's also based in Senegal. So those are the four names that we present in front of the committee for consideration to be included in the what called in the list of potential board members that the minister could appoint. So if the committee approves, then the minister will select from these four names, including Mr. Somaseko, two people who will fit that, will fill those two vacancies that arose as a result of resignation of Professor Sweya and as a result of Mr. Masobe not taking up his position as appointed by Cabinet in September 2009. Thank you.
Honourable members, here's a proposal from the Mr. Mavoso of the Office of the Minister. I see two hands already, Peter, Honourable Smith and Honourable Sheik.
Yes, I thank you for that. So as I understand it, we're not actually ourselves trying to reduce the four down to two. We're being presented with the four. I'm actually quite happy with the four, but I do have a question, and that is whether the department has satisfied itself that the individuals concerned are prepared to put in the work to do the job. I mean, we don't, you know, I'm just thinking of the gentlemen, for example, who are both in West Africa, and I don't know how onerous the board responsibilities are. But, I mean, are these individuals, have they committed to fulfilling their fiduciary responsibilities as board members fully? Because it does seem to me that we're having a higher turnover in board membership than is desirable. For legitimate reasons, probably, but one doesn't want to exacerbate the problem by these individuals also likewise having problems. But I'm happy to accept the four.
Thank you. I'd like to know the process by which the department advertises and evaluates the CVs that come into for board nominations, not only for this board, but for all the boards that we've actually seen since 2009, because there's been a problem with every single one of them. The man who didn't, I believe, on this one, who never actually pitched to any of the meetings, he didn't want to be on the board to start with. So how come he was even actually appointed? The SANSA also had people who were put on the board and didn't take up their positions because they weren't keen on the job. The NRF board, you've had the problem of one dodgy character being appointed to the board, and the person who was initially publicized as the chairman of the board didn't want the job in the first place, and when someone from the department phoned him and checked his, with, you know, whether he would want it, he told them no, and the next thing he finds his name in the newspaper. So I'm wanting to know how thoroughly the department actually evaluates the people, and also do you take the information they give you at face value? Do you actually check with any of the referees that they actually provide whether whether this information is actually correct? And can you please tell me, I have nothing against this man, I can find nothing on him, and bounce his name around my colleagues and they seem to think that he was quite a good guy. But Mr. Madabati, how does he actually earn his living? Because he's been unemployed since April last year. He has no current employer. And that's not saying that he's necessarily, you know, a wastrel or, you know, not doing anything wrong, but do you actually know how he pays his bills? You know, how well do you know this man, is my question. Thank you.
All right, what do
you? Willen, that's going to be my second point, we learn in these committees and these plans as we are moving forward. And I don't know, I need the guidance from you as a chair and you pardon my ignorance. Should we really ask the questions that we are asking of a candidate? I'm finding it a bit upset, if that is the correct word. How then do we ask a department if, how do we know a person is earning his or her living? Is it what we are when we are really checking? Or is that an indication of us not trusting that the department is doing its work diligently and in a manner that is supposed? Even if we are doing that, can I be protected? Because I was quiet when Honorable Shim was asking a question. I didn't make any comment. If we are doubting the integrity of the Department of Science and Technology, how do we do that? I don't have a problem if really you check on a person, you know that the person is not working. Is it something that really can we expect the department to respond to those questions? I'm starting about that, Chair, because I really find it a bit, for me, I'm finding it a bit uncomfortable. And I would request us to be consistent, yes, when we are asking questions about particular candidates that are put forth for any board by the department, for us to look into it by the Department of Science and Technology. The only thing, Chair, pardon me, that I misplaced my document. I saw here, I don't know, I don't have any fundamental problems about the phone names, trusting that the department has done its work. And secondly, if X is appointed in a board and X tomorrow decides not to sit in that board, should the department really be responding to that, take responsibility of that? Because anybody, everybody, even myself, I can be here tomorrow and decide to go and not be in where I am then recommended to be. Is it the fault or the responsibility, or the board must, or the Department of Science and Technology must account on that? I don't think we are fair on that. Again, Chair, pardon me. In this document, there is a CV of a name by Olukoshi. Am I correct? Yes. What are these? Are these the all of these small document things that I hear? Are all those things needed? Where? How many boards a person set on? In page, for instance, if you can start in, it's my last, if you can start from page 4, right up there, quite a number of boards, whatever, here in this document of this particular person. So I want to check whether is this not going to some of the things, or is just a reflection of how experienced and knowledgeable a person is for that person to then be able to be put on the board. I just wanted that clarity.
Yeah, as honorable, as you required some clarification from the chair's desk, I think in the last in your last analysis, you are correct to say that there is no way that the department can know a person whether at one stage he will feel that he wants to move out or not. It is not. But I think on the first point, I think Honorable Shun is correct as a member of this committee, because this committee is here to look. That's why we are looking into that. So she has to find out a person who is not working, what is he, how is he earning the living. I mean, that is a prerogative of the members of the committee exactly to question and to get appropriate answers before we approve. I think she's quite correct there. We need to get the answer from the department. Honorable Muchumi.
Second, thanks, and thanks for that presentation on those candidates or nominees. Chairperson, my question is with regard, like we have some of these candidates or nominees, excuse me, are foreign nationals, no, they are academics, but what I would like to find out is, do they get vetted? Do they get a vetting before they get appointed?
Okay. I think they will answer. I know the answer, but I want them to give you the answer themselves. So, from the department, Mavoso, is there any other input from the committee before I allow Mavoso to respond?
Okay.
I'm fine.
Sorry, maybe so that I don't sound being naive and whatever, because even if I was in another country, I would ask that question. If we have South Africans who would be foreign nationals in that country that I would be in.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Maybe let me begin by the question from Honorable Smith regarding the commitment of these members. Indeed, Honorable Smith, we do interact with this particular potential candidates in relation to their commitments and their ability to serve on this board prior to presenting these names to Parliament for consideration. But I do know that, for example, in case of the Professor Swear, who has recently resigned, that when the circumstances of an individual changes, so sometimes it does pose a challenge for them to fulfill their responsibilities, because normally the boards meet 4 times a year. So I think they do put that as part of their work schedule. But in this case, the potential candidates have been conducted, and they have indicated willingness to serve on the board. And on the process that the department follows in relation to the appointment of candidates on the board, Honorable Shin will understand that we follow the open process, you know, in terms of public nominations. When we call for board nominations, in some instances, some individuals are candidates are actually recommended by other individuals or institutions. In those cases, you know, they required to accept the nomination, so that when they are considered for to fulfill that particular role, they actually it's with their consent. So that's the process that we follow. In terms of verification of individuals prior to submitting the board members for consideration, we do preliminary security clearance with NIA. To get the profile of the candidate. So that process does get followed. So I think that's what we do. But in relation to the candidate in front of us today, Mr. Matabate, I am currently not in the position to provide that particular information, because I am not aware of his current business engagement or current employment, because I think the CV that was provided to us during the process, I did not indicate, so I undertake to check that. I can then communicate that to take that of the committee to forward it to the Honorable Shin. I can do that.
Yeah, well, that actually know what he does, because I did check up. But my point is that, you know, these aren't lucrative appointments. These are prestigious appointments. The guys don't, you know, become a board member here to get rich. It's actually prestigious. And my concern is that are we doing enough to protect the integrity of the board by perhaps being too superficial in the evaluation of the CVs that are put before us? Now, Mr. Bodabati, actually, from what I understand, is a one-man band consultant now. His company is what's called HYM Consulting. He has a page on LinkedIn and a page on Facebook, and he doesn't seem to have any friends or contacts. So, you know, I'm not quite sure how active he is. I don't believe that there's anything wrong with the man. But what I'm saying is that before we go ahead and appoint these people, let's actually just interrogate a little bit about what they do, and A, also their commitment, because some people who have been nominated by others have, when they've been approached, said, no, they're not interested. And then they still find they're on the list. I think there needs to be a closer interrogation of the process. Thank you.
I think I can add on that. Also, if they are in a situation, as I was saying, where they are relevant, or whatever business they are running, where it is relevant to the integrity of the type of board you what. I think she's correct.
My the only comment on all this Amir, all these candidates Amir. But Chair, because we are learning, if we are checking on a particular person, I'm following this because it's only a particular person. I've never seen this person from a bar of soap. I don't know him. But here I'm just trying to understand. If Matabane, we will have to take a fine comb on his profile and his life or whatever. Are we not then to do the rest to the rest of the? I do think that honorable Sin does not respect people. I am to say that here now. When she speaks, we are all attentive, listen to her, give her the respect that she deserves. But I have come to a point that she does not respect other people. And that thing, honorable Chair, it's something that as the committee will have to. Because we have got an ability and capacity to do what she is doing. But it's because of the respect to herself and the respect to the meeting. And I'm humbly requesting you to please try and address that. So I'm saying, Chair, instead of us only because...
Can I quickly address that? Honorable Shin, please, when it is not your turn, don't keep on interjecting because it is disturbing. Okay, all right.
So what I think is going to be important for us as the committee in moving forward for the future is that because if there is only one person that is being picked up, it gives an impression that, in fact, it is only the interest on a particular person. Whereas all of them, if then the department is to have a fine comb in checking everybody what the person is doing, we then have to do that, even if they are foreign nationals for that night. That's what was.
Again,
why I'm raising that, Chair, because it seems as if it's a particular person. And I'm not implying that people must not look into the background of X, but it must then not be as if it is only this one. We will have to do that to all of them.
Okay. Let me also again address that question. I know that members may not know other rules. It is part of the rules of the HSRC administration and the HSRC Act that at least in the board there must be a person not necessary who must not be from South Africa but must from the African continent. So if members don't know that, it is part of the Act that a person in the board of HSRC must also, there must be at least, I can't remember whether one or two or three, but one, there must be a person who is not necessarily from South Africa, who is a good researcher, but from the continent. I think, therefore, that that nomination satisfies that condition of the Act. So people must not question that in terms probably of any xenophobic attitudes. It is in the Act. Because you remember, HSRC is a research institution of Africa, not only South Africa, but which looks into. It was actually developed to look into the problems and challenges of Africa as a whole, as a continent. That is why, therefore, in the Act, they need to be in the board at least a person who is not necessarily from South Africa, but who is from Africa. I think Mavuso was supposed to have answered that. I left it to him to answer because it is in the Act.
Chairperson, in terms of voting, I believe, for instance, My question on vetting. I think much of this is a law. Even people who are here, whatever they're doing, for instance, those who are doing the security, I think the law allows them to live in this country, to do whatever, or to work or to do. But my question, that's why I said I'm not being xenophobic, but I want to know if they are being vetted. And I have a reason for asking that, irrespective of the law. Or it doesn't mean if the law, then it's the law, it means then anybody, everybody can just be taken. That's not what the law says. Thanks.
I think Mabuso will answer that. Can I allow Mabuso to respond? Okay. There you go.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Now, I think I just want to, in addressing the question regarding the foreign nationals, it is indeed, as I said earlier on, all members who are appointed or are recommended for appointment in our boards, we do follow a security vetting exercise, because I think we are wary of employing foreign security agents in our government bodies. Because also I think in taking into account the comments made by Honorable Sheen, I think as part of enhancing and improving our processes, I think the comments that you've made will be taken into consideration. As I said, we have a process of looking at the integrity of candidates that are nominated, but I think those processes can always be improved to make them more watertight. So I think we'll take that into consideration. Just to speak to the issue regarding the member was appointed to chair the NRF board and subsequently declined the nomination or the appointment. There were extensive deliberations, in particular regarding that particular person being a member of the NRF board, also chairing the board. And there was agreement that he is accepting. And then thereafter, after the appointment, the candidate wrote to the minister indicating that the circumstances have changed, because some of the processes, they take long. By the time we appoint, the person's circumstances have changed. For example, if I were to indicate that the member that we're trying to replace, Professor Sweya, has been appointed, to the chair of the presidential committee in Ghana. So therefore indicated that, his time will now be consumed by the work that he will be doing for his country. So similarly, in this case, with the professor who was appointed to chair the NRF board, that was the challenge that we faced at the last minute. So really, processes, so the circumstances do change, and we've got to accommodate that where it happens. But we do try to ensure that we have stability in our boards.
Is that it all? No, but we're still on it.
If in respect of the single candidate, the department is still going to do a little bit more homework, then the question is, what is the status of the four here today, the process going forward?
Chair, the homework that Honorable Smith is referring to, I'm not sure whether, because it's a homework that relates to the question that was asked by Honorable Sheen. The names have been presented here, and we are, as a department, comfortable with the four names that the minister has recommended that they be presented to the to the National Assembly for consideration and approval. So if the committee feels that there's a cloud or unclear uncertainty of a particular candidate, so I think it will be the committee to make the decision whether the name is either rejected or accepted provisionally until clarity is provided. But I would recommend that, I think Honorable Shin didn't object to that. She indicated that she just verified the information and was not having a problem with the candidate per se, but I think the only problem was that there's no clarity of the source, of the current source of income, and the candidate is really not under any cloud as far as I'm concerned. So I think it is up to the committee to decide what to do with the four names. The three have no, I think there are no issues, but it was just that one, which I also don't think it's a negative comment from Honorable Shin, but I think it was just to say, can we verify just for, and that shouldn't stop the process as far as I'm concerned. If I'm wrong, I think Honorable Shin will correct me. Thank you.
Yeah, but can I ask myself another question? Are the four names that are here not part of what we had already approved in that short list?
No, Chair, the four names are not. These are new names. The reason, as I said, the remaining names from the approved 17, we've already used 12 of those names. There's five that are available. They do not, four of them do not fit the criteria for this particular replacement, because we have indicated that we are replacing this one as per Section 5B of the HSRC Act, which requires that they have financial expertise, but also that they should be a distinguished scholar. I indicated in the beginning of my presentation that we do have Mr. Somaseko, who does fit the profile of an African scholar, but we thought that we should add additional names, because we are avoiding a situation where we have to come back to the committee every time there's a resignation in that regard. So if we have the two additional names, at least we know that during the period of the term of the board, should there be any vacancies, we can tap into those. So we want to do this as a comprehensive exercise. Otherwise, we would have brought only two names in relation to the financial expertise. So we thought we should take this opportunity to deal also with this other category, which tends to be a problem if circumstances of those individuals change.
Well, well understood from my side. Honorable Shin?
I'd just like to respond to Mr. Maguza. Yes, you're absolutely right. I raise no objection to Mr. Madabati. I just use his case as an illustration of my concerns of the process. There's absolutely nothing that I would object to.
I was just looking to the procedure, whether by that, because we haven't raised any objection, so it does it really then say that as the committee we are accepting the presentation of the name by the department.
Yeah, I think at this level we need to move and second the approval of the names. And Honorable Smith,
Chair, I move that the committee accepts the four names presented to us.
Seconder, Honorable Shin. Dunza
from the African National Congress, formally second.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Member. So I will now read, therefore, a formal clause to accept the nomination of the names. The report of the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology on the consideration of a short list of candidates for appointment to the board of the Human Science Research Council dated 23rd November 2011. The Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology, having considered the short list of candidates for appointment to the board of the HSRC, tells of Section 5.3 of Human Science Research Council Act 2008, number 17 of 2008, referred to it, CATC of 1st November 2011, recommends that the House approves the shortlist as follows. Professor Adebayo Olukoshi, 2, Ms. Harold Matabane, 3, Dr. Prima Sol, 4, Professor Enrico Ulana. The report has been accepted, therefore, I think I just need to sign it on behalf of the committee. Is that agreed? Thank you. Thank you very much, honorable members. We move to the next item. We are to listen to the briefing by the department now on its regional and international cooperation agreements in relation to the preparation of upcoming conference on climate change and the committee intended international trip to South Korea. Dr. Thomas of the Heide will lead us in this connection.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I would like guidance from you on whether you want me to present on the relations with Korea and China first or on COP17 event first.
No, you are going to drop China now because we now are going to consider only South Korea. You can COP17, of course, is very important. Yeah, you can present it in the way you like.
Thank you, Chair. And since we've got this up, let me then go to the presentation on Korea. I'd like to just highlight, Chair and honourable members, that we had sent through briefing notes on Korea. There were two, one with a cover and one with less of a cover. Perhaps the second one wasn't handed out to you, but I'll leave it with the secretary in case it wasn't. There's a fair amount of detail in there. I won't clearly address all of it. We will be very happy to provide further information if it's at our disposal. Should the committee require further information. There was also attached to it a briefing like this on China, but as you've asked me not to, I shan't dwell on it. Yes, it has been, Honourable Chair, that was sent through several weeks ago, and then there's a copy of the presentation that I'll be making now. I'll run through now only the slides on Korea to save time, Honourable Chair and members. And then afterwards, I'll be referring to this document, which is the COP17 briefing. All right, so first of all, then, turning to the bilateral relations with Korea, the science and technology relationship was formalized through an agreement in 2004, and at the time, the themes that were identified in the agreement covered energy, including nuclear energy, biotechnology, biodiversity, manufacturing, space science and technology, and astronomy. As honourable members will know, normally government-to-government relations between Korea and South Africa or between the Korean Ministry of Science and Technology and the Department of Science and Technology are conducted principally through the so-called joint committee meetings, where on a regular basis, sometimes it's annual, sometimes it's biannual, the senior officials of the two departments get together and they review the cooperation activities and agree how to proceed from there. So the Joint Committee defines and implements and reviews the collaborative projects, for example. Three Joint Committee meetings have already been held with Korea, and the fourth one is scheduled to be held in South Africa probably early next year. It was going to be held towards the end of this year, but because of COP17, we haven't had the space to do it, and neither have the Koreans, who are also very heavily involved in the COP negotiations. The institutional collaboration between Korean and South African institutions is supported by governments through mechanisms such as the hosting of seminars, workshops, exchange visits, and joint research activities. This, honourable members, is just a diagram. I'm sorry it's not all that clear, but I think it's clear enough to see the numbers there, of the level of investment in Korea Now, I think Korea's population is about half the size of South Africa's, no? The population? Oh, okay. Sorry, I was thinking of another country then. Anyway, there you'll see by the solid line in this graph here that in 2008, their gross expenditure on research and development as a percentage of GDP was at 3.37%. It's one of the highest in the world. So considerably higher than the OECD average and more than three times South Africa's level. So this is an enormous level of expenditure. And as you will see in this slide, a significant portion of this is from the private sector. This slide illustrates the size of their science and technology system in terms of the number of researchers involved. FTE stands for full-time equivalent, and HC stands for headcount. Really, the annual breakdown is not so important, but if we just look at the last line, 2008, the three lines below that unpack those numbers for the 2008. So of the 436,000 headcount of research active individuals in that country, 30,000 were from public research institutes, 167,000 from universities, and 238,000 from the business sector. So you can see, Honorable Chair, the enormous influence that the private sector has in Korea on their national system of innovation. There are a range of reasons for it. Of course, what constitutes the private sector today in Korea started off to a large extent 30 to 40 years ago as public enterprises, state-owned enterprises. And the particular trajectory of development of the national system of innovation is not unique to Korea. It was it's a replication to some extent of what happened in Japan after the Second World War as well. It's not necessarily a model that can be implemented in South Africa. We have completely different history and political culture and political systems and so on. But that's probably a key rationale as to why this should be so. If we had gone through the presentation on China, you would have seen that even in China, they say that 68% of their gross expenditure comes from the private sector. But of course, what they consider the private sector in China and what they consider the public sector is probably different from our interpretation. Anyway, so the Korean innovation system has several globally competitive industries. Shipbuilding is one of them, and it's not simply the process of welding steel plates onto a frame. It's a much more complex set of technologies and mixtures of technologies that come into that. Display panels, cell phone design and manufacture, automobile design and manufacture, and then steel and steel products. And again, steel is not just simply it's not a simple operation to produce steel. There's lots of different types of steel. So the technology just in producing steel and then in working it, in manufacturing steel products, there's a lot of technology involved in that. Specifically now, in terms of their science and technology systems, they have significant capacity in communication and broadcast convergence, which of course comes through in their cell phone manufacturing and design industry, phase change memory, display panels and equipment, and intelligent transport systems. Just a brief overview of the current activities. As I said, the written briefing notes have got more details on this, and we would be happy to provide further information should the committee request this. With regard to human capital development, there is an exchange of students for training under the Space Science and Technology and Astronomy Research Programs and Exchange Programs. Korea promotes fellowships and expert missions in the area of biotechnology. There's quite a lot of engagement in this area. Student and scientific exchanges are taking place under our cooperation program on hydrogen and fuel cells. And the Korea Institute of Science and Technology has offered scholarships to and training of South African students. And student researchers based at the CSIR, specifically in the area of nanotechnology, have taken up the offer. So hydrogen and fuel cells, nanotechnology, biotechnology, those are some of the key areas that we're currently cooperating with. Here I've provided just a little bit more information on this in terms of the hydrogen and fuel cells. Much of this cooperation is with the University of the Western Cape, which is a hub for our hydrogen and fuel cell work, as well as the CSIR, of course. They're working together with Korean colleagues on catalysts for fuel cell polymer electrolyte membranes, direct methanol fuel cell polymer electrolyte membranes for high temperature fuel cells, and hydrogen storage. And in nanotechnology, there's research on luminescent nanomaterials for generation of white light with low power consumption, so it's towards sort of green technology, environmentally free technology. There is also, and I forgot to put this on the slide, there's also work on purification of water using nanotechnology. Both work on luminescence, on light production, as well as on water purification, are the main two thrusts within our nanotechnology cooperation. Chair, this presentation would not have been complete without me presenting something on the nuclear cooperation activities. You will understand, of course, that much of this lies outside of the domain of the Department of Science and Technology because it's through NEXA and therefore through the Department of Energy. But nonetheless, there is some overlap with us specifically around the area of human capital development because we have a human capital development program for nuclear technology and the nuclear industry. So the research areas is in the area of research reactors, cyclotrons, pressurized water reactors, and nuclear medicine. Nuclear medicine, of course, being one of the areas of strength at NEXA and in South Africa.
It would be useful because here we are not technical specialists to probably simplify some of these words like cyclotrons.
I'm sure, Chair, you'll be able to do that much better than I am. Just an inorganic chemist. Well, I used to be an inorganic chemist. The institutions involved are obviously NEXA, specifically the Safari aspect, that's the research reactor at NEXA, the Korea Atomic Energy Research Institute, and then something called TANARO, the High Flux Advanced Neutron Application Reactor. It's an institution that is focused on a particular type of reactor technology, and all of them liaise with and cooperate with NEXA. Turning briefly to cooperation in space and astronomy, use of facilities for observation time on Korean and South African telescopes, so our astronomy communities share equipment in Korea and South Africa, and there's a particular focus on near-Earth objects, so that community tells us. We're trying to involve third-party countries, third partners, for mutual benefit, so trying to expand the relationship from just the bilateral cooperation activity to including some strategic partners. For example, African SKA partners might become part of trilateral cooperation activity. So we're trying to use our relationship with Korea and the significant science and technology strengths there to leverage development in key partner countries with the support of Korea. Explore additional space geodesy projects for joint collaboration. Address human capital development through recruitment and training of postdoctoral students with a strong emphasis on radio astronomy. And joint seminars on a biannual basis. Now, although at the moment Korea is not formally part of the global SKA activity, honorable members, they have been participating in all the preparatory discussions, but they're not formally part of the consortium that is establishing the SKA project, and that consortium will in fact be formally formed in about 2 weeks' time. Korea will not be part of the founding body, as it were, of the SKA project, but it is very likely that they will be entering the project within a 12 to 18 month period. So we are busy courting them, specifically around radio astronomy as well, because the process of deciding the SKA you know, it's not decided simply in one room. There's a whole lot of processes that come together. There's influences that may not be formally part of the process, but certainly play an informal role, and Korea is one of those countries. Until recently, we thought China might be in a similar position, but China has now announced that it will formally join the founding body when it's established in 2 weeks' time in Europe. So we're refocusing our efforts on China as well. But I thought just to mention here that radio astronomy cooperation with Korea is an important aspect. Biotechnology, there's an MOU between the CSIR and a Korea Research Institute on biotechnology and biodiversity. And the flagship project has been established. This is a large-scale project on new drug discovery from traditional medicines, focusing on technology transfer and best implementation models. This is the last slide on Korea, honorable members and chair. I thought just to highlight in one short slide our key strategic purposes with Korea. First of all, we need to tap into their innovation expertise. They have been very successful in moving from a system that is strongly driven by a state development model into one where innovation, both in the public, but in particular in the private sector, is underpinning their national economic development with a very strong input from science and technology. And there are certain lessons in that model that we would like to explore for our own development of the innovation economy in South Africa. In specific, we want to try and leverage Korea's investment in green technologies and in the green economy. On your visit to Korea, honorable members, I am convinced that they will emphasize their heavy investment and effort in green economies, green technology, green innovation. Those are all very popular phrases at the moment, they're buzzwords, and they need to be unpacked. But I think that being cynical about them is probably hiding the opportunities that reside in this for South Africa, both locally as well as internationally, domestically as well as internationally. So I would encourage you to explore fully what Korea means by green technology and the green economy, and in what way are they giving effect to their development imperatives through these buzzwords of green technology and the green economy. Thirdly, we need to continue to strengthen our cooperation in nanotech, biotechnology, and astronomy with a stronger focus on radio astronomy, as I've already illustrated. And then lastly, Korea is becoming very active in the multilateral space. Their role in the G20, for example, has been significant. Their role in the OECD is significant, and their role at the climate change negotiations also is significant for a country their size. They are, like South Africa in my view, punching above their weight. And this provides significant opportunities for partnerships, of course, at the national, at the international level, bilateral level, but I'm talking now about science and technology. So cooperating with them in the climate change arena, for example, or in the OECD science and technology consideration.
And in nuclear.
And in nuclear, yes, but as you know, Chair, the nuclear portfolio to a large extent lies outside of the Department of Science and Technology's remit. We provide support to it. You're right, yes. Yes. Chair, that is the last of my slides on Korea. I don't know whether you want me to stop now, and you might have some questions on this, and or do you want me to go on to the COP update?
What do you think, members? Should we finish off COP, or you want to engage with him at this level? Okay. It looks like members want to engage with you at this level. Honorable Shin, Smith, Vett.
Thank you. I'd just like to know a bit more about their innovation system. And obviously, you were too about transferring public enterprises across to private enterprise. And also, what do they have in the way of incentive schemes, rebates for companies involved in R&D.
Thanks, Chair. I wonder maybe I could ask you a very general question, and that is, although I understand, of course, from our point of view that we want to be involved internationally with cooperation agreements of one kind or another, just looking at it from a very narrow intellectual property ownership perspective, how do mutual agreements where there's joint cooperation projects, how does it affect ownership issues, and is that covered in the nature of the agreements? Then I was particularly struck by, the choice of the areas which we cooperate with them is largely our own priorities. I don't see anything which suggests priorities from their side. I mean, all these fields, the hydrogen fuel cells, nano, nuclear, space, are all our, and by all our top, right? They're almost straight out of our system. Where is there something from their side which says, the areas that we're going to help them in? It seems to be very one way, I'm not sure. And then I was also struck when I was looking at listening to you on the nuclear science thing, by two issues. Well, first, I think, aren't we the biggest producer of nuclear isotopes in the world for medical reasons? I think we're the biggest in the world. Is that an area where there would be agreement, working with them? And I was also struck by the fact that this whole nuclear industry on the reactor side is all uranium-based. But I see the Chinese, for example, are working on a thorium reactor model. And I wonder whether we as a country have had, since we have thorium reserves in abundance, whether we have not got any sort of scientific interest in alternatives to uranium energy as opposed to thorium. Thanks.
Hello, okay. I'm not sure whether you'll be able to answer the last question. It interests me, the thorium question. But, okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure whether my response is of interest to you or the thorium question itself. First of all, I need to acknowledge that I will need to provide written input to the Honourable Shun on these questions. I don't have at my fingertips here a useful outline of or descriptive outline of their innovation system, what is unique about it, and certainly on their incentives and rebates, we can get that information, and I commit to doing that and sending that through. On the second set of questions by the Honourable Smith, the IP management, generally what our bilateral agreements, government-to-government bilateral agreements state, is that the IP arrangements will be negotiated between the cooperating parties subject to the relevant national IP regulations. And both countries can be assumed to have IP laws and regulations that would protect their own IP in the national interest. But at the same time, that allow and promote, in fact, the establishment of strategic partnerships between research institutions that see mutual benefit in working together to produce new IP. So there's nothing in our legislation that prevents South African institutions from forming strategic partnerships with international organizations in pursuit of IP. All that is required is that those institutions then safeguard the South African contributions to that. It can be in the form of a shared agreement on who will benefit or how to benefit from any revenue that might flow. So we create a high-level framework for this and then leave it up to the institutions because they have the most vested interest in ensuring agreement on these IP issues. The question about the South African interests being reflected. Well, honourable members, any partner country of ours, any bilateral partner of ours, will only agree to research cooperation activities that they regard to be in their interest. And we will only agree to research cooperation activities that we regard to be in our own interest. So the trick in the bilateral negotiation is to identify the areas of mutual interest. So by definition, Honourable Smith, these areas as much as they are associated with our interests, clearly are, for Korean reasons that they know best, associated also with their interests. We have some idea on this. Biotechnology and biodiversity, for example, they don't have nearly the sort of access to the biodiversity that South Africa does. And like gold and diamonds 100 years ago or 120 years ago, our biodiversity is increasingly being viewed by the international community as a resource for future economic development. And it's not coincidental that almost every developed country wants to work with us in biotechnology, because I'm presuming that somehow they see that as an avenue into strategic partnerships built on our biodiversity. So their interest, for example, in the hydrogen economy and fuel cell work is because they are investing a lot of effort in nanotechnology and in new materials. Nanotechnology, new materials come together in some of the work that we're doing within the hydrogen economy and the fuel cells areas. So I think there's a rationale that brings them to the table that allows a mutual interest to be defined. Is it on there? Shall I just finish quickly? Honorable Dunja, can I finish this quick? Thank you. On the question of nuclear isotopes, yes, I also know that South Africa is a very important player in the nuclear isotope field internationally. But this is a field of activities that is largely managed at the government level. Where it's managed at the government level, it's managed through the Department of Energy and through probably the Department of Health, because the Department of Health is responsible for nuclear medicine regulation, and the Department of Energy, via NECSA, is responsible for producing them. So we don't have, to the best of my knowledge, Honorable Chair and members, we don't have a nuclear medicines program in the Department of Science and Technology. We might be supporting some students in this area, but I don't think that it's a program within the Department of Science and Technology.
Can I clarify you on that, actually, quickly? Because the DG of Health once approached me about nuclear medicine, they also did not have it. They have not. They now have it, and I think the chair is Dr. Gordon Spear. Yeah, so they have it. It's very new. The DG wanted to set it up because felt that it was a gap. There must be an entity dealing exactly with that.
I just remembered that the Department of Science and Technology, as far as I know, does support the activities of a program on a master's program in applied radiation technology at the Northwest University. It's possible that there's a focus on nuclear medicine within that master's program, but I wouldn't know the details of it. But it would be embedded within that master's program. It's not a research program on its own.
That program is about radiation physics.
Oh, that's right.
I know that. Yeah.
And then, lastly, on the question of thorium reactors, the chair will, I'm sure, be able to present his views on this. I'm not going to express views on it. I can just make the point that it's a very complex technology. Well, turning it into a commercial reality does seem to...
But it's not even a commercial level.
Right.
Okay, let me just explain to the member. The thorium isotope is actually converted by bombarding with neutrons into uranium-233, and thorium is understood as thorium-232. So if you bombard it with neutrons, it converts into uranium-233, which becomes a fuel for nuclear reactors or nuclear energy generation. So this is a very easy process. It's not complicated. Okay.
The question as to the development of nuclear technologies in South Africa, and in particular questions about the build program. Of course, policy decisions that lie outside of the Department of Science and Technology. Our activities, as I've illustrated previously, is to ensure that the human capacity, human capital, is in place to support either research in nuclear science and nuclear technology, or to ensure that the capacity is in place to support a nuclear build program. That's the current programs within the Department of Science and Technology.
Hello, Chair. I was actually asking the question in relation to your slide, which talks about pressurized water reactors. And we were also intending to go to China. Now, I know that China is, in fact, involved in heavy research into thorium reactors. And my understanding is the only reason we have conventional uranium reactors was in the 1940s and 50s of the Cold War. They had two purposes. One was military and one was energy. But if there hadn't been a Cold War, we would probably have thorium reactors around us now instead of ordinary conventional uranium reactors of the type that we do have. But so the Chinese, I know, are going that way. So I presume that if we were at China, you know, we would have actually pursued it better.
I can tell you, this is a program connected with pebble battery technology, the one that China is following. Actually, it derived this also from Germany, because the pebble battery technology comes from Germany. China bought a technology from Germany, and they developed their pebble bed, which was exactly the same as our pebble bed there, with what we call a central graphite column. But it has not been able, even the Chinese one, to develop beyond 5 megawatts. And so initially, the Germans, they had operated this technology from 1967 to 1986 using the thorium, which we were talking about. So the Chinese, therefore, are developing that technology, are trying to develop the technology. So it's nothing else but a pebble bed technology, which they are developing based on they are trying to upgrade the power, but they have not been able until now. You know why? They won't be able, because they don't have the graphite properties that were used. They are already finished, which are useful for upgrading the power.
I'm quite interested. When you don't understand, when you're talking about granules and whatever, speaking about grains. I want to make a thank you, Chair, to you on a more serious note. I want to make a request, which is a very humble request from all the researchers here. We are preparing to go to a trip. And the request is, because I think this is the last portfolio committee before we go to a trip. A thorough preparation be done. Obviously, a thorough preparation in terms of everything, in the research, so that we are all at the same wavelength. We will know the chair will always be above us by virtue of his expertise in the field of science and technology, and I'm not quite sure whether the department working together with the researcher of the portfolio committee, and if that is possible for us to get that before we leave, so that we don't. I'm raising this chair because I find myself in a situation last week, which was a bit uncomfortable for me as a member of parliament. But I said to myself, that will never happen to me again. And I wouldn't expect any member of this portfolio committee, nor a member of parliament, to be subjected to that situation that I was subjected to. So that we are all at the same wavelength, we understand, even if then obviously we'll be expected to do our own organic research. Read, but I am of the understanding that the research of the committee from today, liaising with Shanaz, knowing exactly, I don't know whether the trip has been approved, that preparation is to be, because we will be going there not as members of the ISP or members of the ANC or members of COP or whatever. We will be going there as the as Parliament, and therefore we need to be assisted within that context. That is the and encourage ourselves as members of the portfolio committee also to try and read. Obviously, we won't go into deep science word, but the issues that are, I think, will then assist us in moving forward. One question that just clarity, and I don't think I'm expecting that to be responded now, maybe in doing the work. As the country, we have got some seminars, whatever, with Korea. Now, in some of the areas, it's something to do about nanotechnology on water purification. What comes into my mind is that we've got municipalities. Therefore, is there any training program with provinces or with municipalities, with Korea, so that we are, within this short space of time, we're just able to check with those municipalities or provinces that have got some training program or project on how are those things, what is the end result, or how are those municipalities benefiting from those countries? That's the only the comment, Chair, and a humble request that I wanted to put up.
I think you're right, Honourable Member. You know, I was just talking to Shanazia. The group CEO of research in Samsung. He is a member of this Science and Technology and Society Forum of Japan. We have met with him there. He has now moved. He recently wrote to all of us who are from that forum that he has been moved to. There's a university there that deals with kind of management of technology and things like that. I'm sure it would be advantageous for the committee to tap on that. But also, the advisor to the president of South Korea is the chairman of the Astronautics of Korea. We went with you in Prague. He was there, if you remember. And he is also in the nuclear program of Korea. So we also need to tap into that. So therefore, we need, as you are saying, to have a preparation. I'm not sure whether the researcher will be able to help us in that. We need to talk to her. There she is behind us to tap into, because also you went to South Korea, you saw how they are very active in the astronautics. So we can tap into that. It's one of the most important things. But also we can use the influence here, South Africa, in this project of a trillion nuclear. Investment is discussing with South Korea. We need to tap into that. There are many exciting things about South Korea, actually. We need to tap into all of them. Am I wasting my time?
No.
Because I don't finish, but I had to.
I saw you looking the side. I thought you were going to hand it back.
No, because he is the one addressing us. I was trying to get his support into what I'm saying, if he has more things to say. Yeah.
No, that's why I wanted to speak before. So that's why. Because I think maybe you speak and you speak and he responds. Maybe, if you want to comment, I'm going to suggest that if he is to respond, let us put whatever, then he'll respond to all what not. He responds to each and every person that speaks, or after every person who speaks. Chairperson, I was listening to Honorable Dunja. I thought she would raise something that I was going to raise, but she didn't raise. he said he was subjected to something. Chairperson, last week I was part of the members who met with the French delegation. And Chairperson, I'm supporting the issue that there should be a researcher. I was quite perturbed because I was there, sitting there. I didn't know, first of all, what was expected of us as the committee. What were we to do with the French delegate or to the French delegation? And my thinking maybe was that if we were, they would have stated what is it that they are here for, and the committee prepares, and we get the briefing notes so that we know exactly what is it that we are going to prepare. So I'm not sure even if they did get what they, or maybe they were on an outing to come to Parliament. Because I doubt if they did get anything from this committee, because they're just waffling, saying whatever was that comes to our mind about science, you know, not knowing whether was that the relevant information that they needed from us. And the other person on my side, it doesn't speak well of us. So I request that you said you're not sure whether the researcher, it's the responsibility of the researcher to ensure that he or she gets all the information if we are to go in a trip, to undertake any trip, or if there are people who are to visit the country, to get what is it and research and give it to the members. Much of the members do read, but they must be, that is the purpose of Parliament appointing researchers, to ensure that they reinforce, they capacitate the committee members or the committee itself. That's my earnest and humble plea that we please be provided with that. If you are saying you're not sure that the researcher can do that, she can or he can do that, Chairperson. Thanks.
I don't know what exactly happened last time. Maybe they will be going to prove me.
No, I didn't say just the I think she's correct. There was a little bit of a challenge in terms of coordination. Remember that there was plenary, there was this. We didn't respond on time. Who is really going to attend to that? And I remember Comrade Chanas keep on saying, my apologies, Miss Isaacs, she was checking on us who is available in terms of the committee members, and we were just all over doing some of the work, and at the time then it was clear because we were aware that you're not going to be here. Then I had to squeeze some of the things so that at least the we go and meet the delegation. Now, what then transpired in the process is that because I pick up late in the day that, gosh, I am to go and attend, I requested the researcher to just give me 2 pages, I think. I got that. Unfortunately, I had to read in between. And I think it's one time that I really accept the word waffling, because I could really pick up that text. We are on our side, with as a leader of the delegation of the committee at that particular time. That is why I was then saying, I hope it won't happen to anybody. Because what then, maybe I should have said we were subjected to, it's something that leaves much to be desired. It is then that is why I think she is raising an issue that at least when visitors are coming, we will have to know what then are the objectives of their visit, and then be assisted in preparing so that when we go there, even if we are not going to go, all of us as members, at least we are all aware. I'm saying if Honorable Smith was not going to be there, but he is aware that at least there are these and these are the points that we will have to focus on. And be able and be. So I think what she is raising is the issue of how best then are we then being assisted by the relevant unit, whether the unit dealing with international watch or the researcher, both, if they are both, to check if they can then assist, and we go there empowered. I did get a two-pager document from the researcher, which was more a general and a bit. So in between, I'll have to pick up and then try and remind myself what is it that in terms of innovation and what then. But I think he is correct. It's Honorable Shin who was, I think we'll have to say it here, because it can't be a secret, that who then maybe having looked into that and have a chance of preparing and come and be more direct on the. But that is why my question then says, my proposal was that a preparation must be done for all members to be at the same wavelength, without, notwithstanding the fact that we have got a responsibility to read, but relevant units, people that have got a responsibility given by Parliament of assisting a committee and members. That will have them to do that. So I think that's what we were trying to put across. We're not blaming anybody here, but we are then saying, what are the lessons that we are drawing from the challenges that we have been faced with? Otherwise, it was even, now we're coming into something that is not part of the agenda. Otherwise, the meeting did take place, Chair, at a relevant time. We will then give you the report, but otherwise it's out of that experience that I was then making this particular having this particular proposal. Thank you, Chair.
I think at this point, this is this is how it's supposed to be done. It's supposed the committee, our committee in the visiting delegation, was supposed to ask them what are their areas of focus that we must ourselves prepare on. That's what we do when you go to many countries, especially at international level, they ask the chair to summarize the areas of focus of what they would like to see in the overview. For instance, when we go to Korea, the researcher has prepared a general overview of what South Korea is all about. But we, as a committee, we are supposed to then tell them that these are the areas of our interest. Out of all what they do or out of all the cooperation that they have, we are interested in looking into that and that and that and that. When we went to Sweden, you must know, the Swedes, they said, we did, because that's a part of motivation if you are going for an oversight talk. You must motivate why you are going to the country. So I motivated why we're going to Sweden. But the first secretary in our embassy came back and said, they say this is too general. The Swiss are saying this is too general. They want us to be specific because they are very busy. They don't want to just generally focus on science and technology development of Sweden. They want us to be specific of exactly what we want to understand about the Swedish science system. Well, I think our first secretary was out of order himself, because when we went to Sweden at the end, we found that they had not said that. But he had thought that we don't know what we can move for. Then we started to be very focused, to be very thorough about what we wanted, and went into very deep technology focus, which actually troubled the Swiss a lot. When we came there, they said that they had to go look for professors to focus on all those things, and they had a limited knowledge of the things they wanted to see. So I'm trying to say, therefore, that like when you go to Korea, we have to tell the Koreans that this is what we want to focus on, and therefore the researcher can hear look and organize material for us around the area that we want to focus on. I do not know how that is going to happen because this is the last day today. But probably we can, me and the researcher, we can work together so that then she circulates through channels that type of material during the time of vacation. But I think I've already, as I said, I've already two areas that I've already said we must talk about in South Korea, but there are many. On my way to the World Science Forum, I read a lot of what the Koreans have, and so we have a lot to really focus on. The researcher then is only to research and distribute the material to you, so that by the time we go there, we know exactly what we want to see. I think that's that about that. It was unfortunate that the French did not. The committee, it's not the French, it's the committee was supposed to tell them what they want to focus on, so that when they came here, they would be knowing that we are expecting this interaction. It's part of us that we're supposed to tell them what we want to focus on, or they were supposed to tell us what they want to focus on when they come to us, so that we prepare accordingly. Right. I think you can deliberate on COP 17 now. Thank you. And it has a very big center of focus in the World Science Forum that I come from. It took a center stage. So be careful that you say what they say.
I'll do my best, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I want to emphasize that this is not a presentation on COP 17. It's a presentation on the DST's role in COP 17. I'm hoping that our colleagues in Environment Affairs and or International Relations and Cooperation might have briefed you. So I want to be clear, this is about the Department of Science and Technology's role in COP 17, not broadly about COP. And I'm presuming that you've had some briefing as parliamentarians and politicians on South Africa's approach at the highest level to these negotiations. An important perhaps point to remind you of, which I'm hoping has been shared with you, is that it has been a challenge for South Africa to ensure that the expectations of Durban are realistic and not unrealistic. And particularly in the last few weeks, various South African figures in the climate change negotiations have tried to emphasize this point, that what South Africa wishes to do in Durban is ensure that the outcomes that were agreed in principle at the last meeting in Cancun, that those outcomes are taken to the next step, that South Africa should not be seen as a point or a country that is going to broker agreements between the giants in the climate change negotiation. That, you know, we're proud of our history and what we've achieved, but that doesn't mean that we can broker deals between countries whose engagement with the climate change issues are much, much bigger than our own. So that's the context at the highest level for what we are. So we wanted to be good and gracious hosts and effective organizers of the conference of the parties, and we wanted to make sure that the agreements that were struck in principle in Cancun are taken to the next stage, but not that they're catapulted into some, you know, unrealistic agreement. All right, so having said that, some of this may be familiar to honorable members, and I apologize if it is, but essentially the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiations take place in two main tracks. The first one is called the Ad Hoc Working Group on Long-Term Cooperative Action, the AWG-LCA. The second one is called the Ad Hoc Working Group on the Kyoto Protocol. It's a longer name, but I've shortened it to the Kyoto. And it's shortened to, its acronym is the AWG-KP. So these are the two tracks, the in shorthand, we talk about the LCA track and the KP track. The LCA track is the one that looks, as is shown in the third bullet, specifically at issues around mitigation, adaptation, financing, and technology transfer. The KP track is the one that looks at what type of legal instrument might replace the Kyoto Protocol. So the LCA track looks at, as the name implies, long-term cooperative actions. What can we do in the absence of or in parallel to the establishment of a legal instrument, while the KP track negotiates the legal instruments? Now, the technology transfer negotiations, as I've indicated, take place under the LCA track, the long-term cooperative actions track, in parallel with negotiations around mitigation, adaptation, and financing. In Cancun, at the end of last year, under the technology transfer negotiation track, there was agreement to establish two bodies. The one is called the Technology Executive Committee, the TEC, and the other is called the Climate Technology Center and Network. And in reality, what happened was that in the Cancun outcome, which was basically a document, I can't remember the length of the document, 10, 12 pages, 15 pages, something like that, there is a section in there that says there shall be established a Technology Executive Committee, and then there's a few bullets explaining what the terms of reference are as far as they were agreed in Cancun, and then there's a paragraph that says there shall be established a Climate Technology Center and Network, and there's also then a few bullets that define the terms of reference or the mandate of the CTCN as far as they were agreed at Cancun. That's what came out of the Cancun event with regard to the technology transfer. The task throughout this year and for Durban will be to then, the word is operationalize, the Technology Executive Committee and the Climate Technology Center and Network. Effectively, it means that at the end of the Durban meeting, there must be agreement on the composition of the Technology Executive Committee, and as I'll show you just now, that's been finalized already, and on the exact terms of reference. What exactly will they be doing at a level of detail that is greater than the one that was finalized in Cancun? And the same thing is true for the Climate Technology Center and Network, the CTCN. There must be agreement on, at a greater level of detail than was in Cancun, on what the CTCN should be doing, and how is it different from the TEC, or how are they related to one another? So it's negotiating basically what will this body be doing and how will it be constituted. And another important thing is the process whereby it will be constituted. All right, so turning now to specifically then these two issues, the technology transfer negotiations. And now on these two matters of the TEC and the CTCN. The Technology Executive Committee was established in July this year. In the negotiations in Bonn at that time, there was agreement reached on how the body should be constituted, how many people or should be on it, how many countries rather should be represented on the Technology Executive Committee. And essentially, Africa as a negotiating bloc is represented by three countries, Algeria, Kenya, and Sudan. South Africa at that time, through negotiations between the Department of Science and Technology, Environment Affairs, and DIRCO, we agreed not to nominate South Africa to be part of the Technology Executive Committee, because for the next year, while we are the president of the Conference of the Parties, we are entitled to attend meetings of any COP bodies that are established, including these TEC, this TEC, as an observer. So we will be attending these meetings as observers throughout the year of our presidency, and indeed we did participate in the first meeting that was held in, I think it was September this year or August, something like that, the first meeting of the Technology Executive Committee. So South Africa will continue to serve as an observer to the TEC during 2012. We already participated in the first meeting. And in addition to that, of course, Because we're part of both the Africa and the G77 and China groups, we have an ability to request our representatives to raise matters within the Technology Executive Committee. The Technology Executive Committee at the highest level is considered to be or is envisaged to be a policy advisory body that advises the conference of the parties as well as member states on policy, on technology policy issues relating to climate change, mitigation and adaptation. So it's a policy advisory body. The Climate Technology Center and Network, on the other hand, is envisaged more as an implementation body, a body that will assist, will broker the establishment of technology transfer partnerships. So where countries need to develop or transfer technologies for mitigation or adaptation, and other countries or bodies or companies might have those technologies or might be in a position to develop them, the technology, the CTCN would try and broker agreements between those who have technologies and those who need them in order to transfer and or develop these technologies. So it's more an implementation body. So there are three key issues that will need to be discussed and finalized in Durban around the CTCN.
Sorry, you know, I read this document. I was very disturbed, actually, myself, because I have been participating in the G8 and G5 countries on this climate change. South Africa has actually been leading in the road mapping of all its equation from Bali up to now. And for South Africa not to be in the ETC, to be in the TEC and say, we will just come as observer because we have an ex officio status. I think it was very ill informed. It was very ill informed as far as I'm concerned.
Chair, the rationale that was presented to us by Environment Affairs and DIRCO jointly was that it would be imprudent of South Africa to be present both in its capacity as president of the COP, as well as having a delegate on the TEC. It's some of the unspoken rules of these negotiations. Chair, I'm just reporting to you the advice that we received at the time.
Actually, I was in Cancun. That's why I'm saying I found, actually, our environmentalist negotiators. I attended the briefings in the evenings in Cancun. I found our negotiators that they were way out of the point, and I had to do a lot of listening up to tell them what they are supposed to be doing. They were way out of what really happens at the level of the G8 and G5 Congress. They didn't know, and they were from they are the people who are actually leading the show there. And that's why when I saw this, I saw that this is another ill information. Okay.
Thank you, Chair, for your views on this. If I can continue with the Climate Technology Center and Network, as I've already explained, the intention is for this to be more at an implementation level. There are three key issues that need to be resolved in the Durban negotiations. The first is the nature of the relationship between the TEC and the CTCN. The G77 plus China group see the Technology Executive Committee really as being the body through which the CTCN reports to the Conference of the Parties. The developed countries largely want to separate the CTCN from the TEC and have it reporting in some way to the COP, to the Conference of the Parties directly. Because their argument is that the TEC is essentially a political body and they don't want the operations of the CTCN to be held hostage to the politics of that body. This is their view. I'm not saying I share it, but this is their view.
Actually, this is where the gist of the problem comes in. And so the problem that we found in Cancun
was that our negotiators are just departmental officials without no political insight of what actually these big countries want to do in order to divide, to divert from real responsibilities. That's the main point. And that is why I'm saying the TEC now to have South Africa as leading and in fact representing the positions of the AU amongst other things, it's very helpful.
Thank you again for that. As I said, there will need to be negotiated how to structure this relationship. There's agreement that both the TEC and the CTCN do need to report to the Conference of the Parties politically, but it's the mechanism whereby that happens that has to be negotiated. The second important issue is the selection criteria and the process for identifying the CTCN host. The CTCN is almost certainly, I mean, nobody has there have been no discussions about exactly what the CTCN would look like. But I am fairly certain that in the end it's going to be an international organization consisting of some 30-odd people who have a background in technology management and technology development, science management, business development, sort of collectively, and they will, their task will be, as I said, to be knowledge brokers to bring together partnerships around the development and transfer of technologies. I imagine if one were to take a snapshot of views on this, those who have a view would probably have something along these lines. Informally, those are the impressions that I've gained from discussions with others. So in the context, a 30-person international organization is actually a small deal. It's not a big deal. Our research institutions are significantly bigger than that, and ours are small on the global scale. So, but it has a long history, this discussion around it, and so there's still a lot of contestation around it. But the point is that it would be best to situate the CTCN in an existing organization that already has governance structures, finance mechanisms, HR mechanisms, and so on. So that's why this notion of the host for the CTCN arose. The idea would be to invite institutions to bid to host the CTCN on behalf of the Conference of the Parties. These could be research organizations that could bid for this. I would be very surprised if we don't have things like the African Development Bank or the World Bank bidding to host this. We don't know, but we have to design a selection criteria and a process that would allow this question to be finalized: where should this thing be hosted? And it would need to be informed by the UN procurement procedures, because to a large extent those would need to be used for this selection process. And then lastly, the governance structure. Who should govern this climate technology center and network? And at the one extreme, a view presented by the U.S. and Japan is that the governance structure for this climate technology center should be assembled by the host organization. So whoever is hosting this thing should determine the governance structure, in other words, the board or the council of the CTCN. That, for us, is an absurd situation, because the governance structure always reports to the body that appoints it. The boards of our public institutions report to Parliament or the Ministry or the Presidency. Those who appoint them, that's where they report. So to argue that a host should be making the appointment of the government structure is absurd, because this body will then not report to the Conference of the Parties, it will report to the host effectively. So we're needing to finalize how exactly is this governance structure going to be constituted. Now, the key outcome at a national level for South Africa, as I've mentioned before, is to ensure that those institutions that were agreed in principle in Cancun are now established in Durban, so that next year they can start becoming operationalized. So the key outcome for COP is the establishment and finalization of the TEC at a conceptual level and the CTCN at a conceptual level. Now, it is possible
that South Africa may have a formal role to play in the establishment of the CTCN as COP, as president of COP, because that avoids having to fight about who's going to chair the governance structure for the CTCN. If you say in the first year, let the president of COP deal with this. So this is one possible outcome of this discussion. Now, what as host and as president of COP, our responsibility is obviously A, to negotiate on behalf of South Africa, but B, we also have a responsibility as the presidency of COP to move the process ahead, to make sure that we break log jams, deadlocks, wherever we find them. Now, with regard to the issues that are outstanding around the Climate Technology Center and Network, we have already developed a plan on how to prepare the ground so that we don't deadlock too badly around this. South Africa and the United Arab Emirates, for example, are putting together a draft selection procedure and evaluation criteria for the CTCN host, and India and Belize will focus on issues related to the governance. And we're putting this work together as input into the negotiation process so that we don't arrive there with a mouthful of teeth on the first day of COP and there's nothing to put on the table. So we're trying to assist the negotiations in that way. The second issue is that intellectual property rights, I'm sure the honorable members will know that this has been raised previously as a matter to be discussed, and some countries have referred to the international regime of intellectual property rights, but they never put it into as many words as that. They just say intellectual property rights are an obstacle to technology transfer, but it's seldom qualified in any helpful way. Now, we have anticipated that IPR, intellectual property rights, will be raised again as a matter to be discussed in the COP agenda, and indeed yesterday that was confirmed to me. And the key interlocutors on the G77 plus China group in this regard, who have strong views on this that are at odds with a general consensus around this, are Bolivia, Ecuador, and India. Bolivia and Ecuador, for the purposes of this discussion, can be considered as a unit because they have exactly the same opinions and the same way of engaging. And if the Bolivian colleague isn't there, the Ecuadorian is, and the other way around. What we have done in order to ensure that progress on finalizing the TEC and the CTCN, which is our strategic objective as a nation, and president of COP to make sure that these things are finalized, to ensure that this doesn't derail progress in regard to those objectives, we have begun to prepare for a discussion on IPR because it will be raised. And what we've done is, first of all, we have met with the DTI to agree on a key set of principles around intellectual property relating to the UNFCCC negotiations. We need to be sure that nationally there is one view on IPR issues within the COP17 environment, and we have drafted the document that sets out these principles. I have written to my Indian colleague confidentially to try and understand exactly what is at the heart of their view, because it's never clear to me to what extent India might be posturing by comparison to actually having substantive arguments in this regard, because in India, the basic principle in India is also private property of intellectual property, private ownership of intellectual property, but the state has reserved walk-in rights where it is in the national interests for humanitarian needs, and that is the same basis for our intellectual property approach. We support private ownership of IP, but the state reserves walk-in rights. And there is nothing in the international property regime under the World Trade Organization that prevents countries from doing this. IP is a national competence, and countries decide what their approach is. So we've tried to understand what their position is so that we can accommodate their views in a way. But the basic point that we will be making is that the UNFCCC
is not the appropriate forum for negotiating international IP, the international IP regime. The multilateral forum for doing that is the World Trade Organization. That is specifically set up to negotiate IP issues. However, it is important in the context of the UNFCCC negotiations for countries to air their views about concerns they've got with regard to IP issues, so that, if necessary, the Conference of the Parties can formulate an opinion on this and communicate that to the World Trade Organization so that it can be considered there. So that's the fundamental argument and approach that we would want to put on the table in the event that this matter is raised. So these are the preparations that we have made and the approach of the department on behalf of South Africa within the negotiations. The last slide, Chair, is just briefly. Us hosting COP17 presents us with two opportunities or two tasks. The one task and opportunity is to promote the negotiations. And that was the previous few slides that I've outlined to you. The second is for us to highlight some South African contributions in respect of climate change. And this last slide, I won't go into the details because the document, Honourable Chair and members, that we presented to you has at the back a list of projects in landscape form that the Department of Science and Technology and its partners have put in place to demonstrate some of the activities, science and technology activities in South Africa that are relevant to climate change. There are some that have taken place already prior to COP. Most of these are already completed. And then during COP itself, there are some projects that we'll be demonstrating there as well. These are mostly on schedule. The delivery of materials to Durban has commenced. Just to mention that we will be highlighting the Joule, the electric vehicle there. Our emphasis in highlighting it will be to promote the work that we're doing on the battery technology. DTI has asked to also demonstrate the Joule, and their emphasis will be on our attempts to use this as a driver for innovation. And then there is something called the Mzansi House, which is an energy-efficient house project that the department has been supporting, and this will be showcased at the COP event in the form of a 3D hologram. I haven't yet seen it, so I don't know, I can't envisage quite how this is going to work, but I will be going down on Sunday to inspect it. If it's a problem, we will have to revisit this, but everybody assures us this is very impressive. So the details of the project are in here, Honourable Chair, and I am happy to provide more if there's more details the Honourable Members would want. Thank you.
There is the presentation, Honourable Members, on COP17. I see Honourable Smith with the hand there. There are a lot for me, but I will not engage you because we will meet in Durban and we will discuss.
I look forward to that, Chair.
There are many things that I needed to really brainstorm. Yeah.
Okay. Just to thank the Dr. Aftahara for the presentation. I've only got one question, actually, because the issue relates purely to the department, the presentation purely to the role of the department, and that is under the LCA track, there are four issues, mitigation, adaptation, financing, technology, transfer, and the entire presentation relates to the DST, and it's all within the technology transfer field. Is there no role of DST in either than any other three fields?
That's the question. Any other question? Let me ask a few very easy ones. The first one is science and technology has a very big role than people imagine in the climate change debate. I do not think that the role of science and technology can only be reduced to what is happening. Actually, in the conference where I come from, they dealt with one of the two issues they dealt with in thoroughness using science and technology was food security and water security. I was impressed. I saw that we have not done anything. I asked for those papers because I want to circulate them to the committee to see where science and technology is actually involved in terms of leading this debate, to show even other, all these departments, that science and technology is very central in this. It's not supposed to play a relegate a role in this. It's supposed to be leading, actually. The second thing, I do not see the role here. I think there are too many structures that are being formed and that are not relating to the central core, which is the IPCC of the UNFCCC. And that makes the whole debate totally apart, because if it's not structured systematically, it's not going to work. Thirdly, there is very little that is being done. Actually, that one of the most challenging things, if you go to this, on Thursday, I was woken up by SABC in Copenhagen, in Budapest, to participate in the show, in the talk show of the morning. I was woken up at 4:30 and then in Budapest, just to talk how much have we done to take the communities along with us, which has been a very central thing of the G8 and G5 countries, that we need to have public hearings, we need to listen to civil society, we need to address the concerns of civil society to take them along with us. Very little work done at that level. And it's a nightmare. And I think the international relations, the environment, science and technology, finance, they are very central. The fund, the Green Fund, we in Rome, we invited 10 CEOs of very top corporations of the world. And they supported that. They would support if we come with a DARE program. IDs of Japan, IDs of China, World Bank, all of them, they were there in Rome. But it's not been consistent. We have not developed this debate systematically. It's a bit.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I just a few responses on that. Maybe just starting off with your last comment, we have not developed this debate systematically. In an absolute sense, you're completely right. The reality of the fact is that you have, in the Conference of the Parties, 190 different opinions on the structure of the debate. And against that background, it's a little difficult to envisage how else this could have worked. So you're right, rationally, you're completely right. But what has emerged, it has emerged out of everybody's best efforts. It's a glib response, but I'm afraid it's the best one that I can make at the highest level on this matter. Turning to some of your specific issues, yes, you're absolutely right that science and technology has a key role to play. It's clearly not the only role player, but it has a clear role to play with regard to climate change. What I have presented here, of course, is not the department's response to climate change. It's only the department's role in the climate change negotiations. The department's response to climate change is a global change grand challenge. And as you all know, Chair, there are a number of interventions under that. The Risk and Vulnerability Atlas is one of them. The establishment of access is another. The establishment of several international partnerships is another. It might be useful if the committee would want this. I don't know that you've had a presentation on the Global Change Grand Challenge, and it's the variety of plans underneath it and structures and the issues, because, for example, food security and water security are being picked up there as issues that have to be addressed. So it might be useful, Honourable Chair, for you to consider as a committee whether you would want to invite the department to come and make a presentation to you on this particular area. It's too late now to do it before the COP, but you know, hopefully there will be a sustained engagement with issues of climate change in South Africa, so that time will never be too late for this. I would certainly offer this on behalf of the department. Again, the point you made about too many structures beyond the IPCC, again, you're right in principle. But the structures that have emerged out of all these different parties coming together and feeling that there were certain issues that needed to be picked up and they couldn't be picked up within the existing set of structures, including the IPCC. Now, whether the IPCC could or should have done that or not, it's a different issue, but that's clearly what informed, I presume, the decision to establish some of these structures. The question of the involvement of communities and public hearings and so on, you may know, Chair, that the Department of Environment Affairs and DIRCO have driven a process of public communication and public consultation, and they have held a series, or to the best of my knowledge, they had planned to hold, and I think they have held, a series of events in all of the 9 regions of South Africa around climate change in an attempt to engage communities and use the hosting of COP as an opportunity to raise awareness around COP. Whether that has been successful or not,
I only started now, only about a month ago. This has been a call since 2008, which has not happened.
Yeah. I accept that. My closing comment was going to be, Chair, that in preparations for the year and specifically for the event in December, there was at the highest level of in Cabinet a discussion that clarified the roles of different departments with respect to climate change broadly and the COP17 event specifically. And within this, the Department of Environment Affairs and the Department of International Relations and Cooperation were given lead roles and lead agencies in this area. The Department of Science and Technology's responsibility was specifically around the technology transfer negotiation. But, as I said, our departmental response to climate change, of course, goes way beyond the small contribution that we're making within the climate change negotiations. It's in the form of the Global Change Grand Challenge. And then you had one specific question about the cross-cutting nature of some of these. No, sorry, that was Honourable Smith. I think you raised the questions around the mitigation, adaptation, and financing, whether we don't have any interface as a department with these things or whether the negotiation track that we're involved in. You're quite right. Of course, there's a strong cross-cutting element. The discussions around the CTCN and what it will do are very strongly dependent on the outcome of the discussions around the Green Climate Fund, which the Chair referred to earlier on. We don't yet exactly know how the Green Climate Fund is going to be structured, what sort of finance is going to be there. Is it going to be only infrastructure finance, or is it going to be project finance as well? So the work of the CTCN, the work in the technology transfer negotiations does need at certain times always to be informed by what happens in the others. And during the two-week period of the negotiations that happens, we have, at least within our caucus of South Africa and Africa and G77 plus China, every day there's a caucus meeting, South Africa, Africa, G77 plus China. And every day, at the end of the day also, we report to each other what has happened in these different caucuses that I've just mentioned now, and we try and coordinate across the different negotiation tracks and then national, regional, and global positions as in G77 plus China, Africa, and South Africa. So
we do try to inform the negotiations in one small part by everything that happens in the others as best as we can.
I mean, is it the case that on those other three tracks, there are other departments of state, Baskin, that are playing a lead role? Is our key department in the sector those four yourself?
No. We are only the lead with respect to the technology transfer.
So our other departments are in the other.
That's right, yes. So it's to a large extent, well, it would be a partnership often between environment and maybe mineral resources and or energy. Transport is there and has quite an active role because many of the negotiations are around transport things like bunker fuel taxes. I mean, I don't understand it all, but the Department of Transport is heavily involved in this. Additional taxes on air transportation is part of the negotiations. So there's a Department of Transport participation in that. So Department of Trade and Industry sits in on many of the negotiations. They don't, to the best of my knowledge, lead any of the negotiations, but they certainly are critical. No, there is actually, there are some, like the bunker fuel thing, I think they lead on that, supported by transport. So there's a partnership that exists between several between several government departments on all of these.
No, thank you very much, DDG. Let me tell you a very short summary of the challenges of COP 17. COP 17 is supposed at least in the list to concretize some of the things that I've talked about, the green funding, the CDM, and so forth. And also, therefore, to make Kyoto Protocol 2 a success, that we sustain that in 2012, we do not abandon everything. We find a way of taking it through. But the biggest challenge lies with China and the United States. And whether you like it or not, these are the biggest polluters and the biggest world powers. And you see, let me tell you, in the in the international climate change debate, especially in the G8 and G5 countries, the problem, which is advanced by the United States, is very understandable. But also the problem that is advanced by China is also very understandable. But the problem, they are parallel. They are parallel and they will never meet. And so the world will therefore never meet. China says we are not responsible. Our development has nothing to do with the responsibilities. The IPCC has got a nice clause which was very well thought of. Responsible. But differentiate, I mean, what they call it, common but differentiated responsibility. The United States says we borrow money from China. Now, China is a superpower. We can't bail out China. China bails us out. We can't convince the American citizens to bail out China. China falls in the context of the common but really it falls with us. It's a very difficult debate. So that is the gist of everything if we want to solve the problem. So China is saying that we are going to go our way. We are responsible at a differentiated level and so we're going to do our best. We don't care about the United States. And the United States says, I'm not going to be part of you. And that's a problem. That is where the gist lies. And so we can say anything that we like, but if the two superpowers and biggest polluters and biggest industrialists then we are just working on a very difficult debate. So that's what I can say. But all we can do is to try and do our bit. And that's all we can do. And sustain the Kyoto Protocol to phase two beyond 2012. That was our responsibilities as commissioners of the G8 and G5, that if we can take through the protocol beyond 2012, that would be the greatest thing to do. Fortunately, some of us now have been handicapped because we haven't been participating in this debate consistently. And that's the gist of the thing. But thank you very much for your presentation. I think the members would be satisfied that you tried your best, and that our department also has tried its best to advance the possibilities of Kyoto Protocol Phase 2 to be retained and so forth. There is nothing we can do beyond this until China and the United States agree. I think at that level, I would therefore, on behalf of the committee, thank you for having come and presented to this. At least those members who are going with me to COP17, at least they have an idea of where the challenges lie and how to go about when we are there. Actually, the minister yesterday said to me he's very glad to see that at the end we are able to have a delegation from committee going there. It would make a difference in its own right. I think it will.
Chair, I would I meant to earlier on and I forgot to do it, so let me do it now. We would certainly very much welcome members of the committee, honourable members of the committee, to visit the DFT project that will be exhibited there. I will make sure that via the secretary you have a list of the, it's in here, but we can provide more details of the venues, and there may be some additional events that may be of interest. So we will keep updating your secretary, and we would certainly look forward to being able to meet some of the members of the committee in Durban at DST or Science Technology events. We have these two projects in the UN precinct itself. We will have the two projects. The one will be the Mzansi House that will be displayed in the form of a hologram, and the other will be the Jewel. And then in the broader precinct, we'll have a few more events happening, and there are things like book launches and symposia and so on that are in the program as well. And I think they're in the document that I sent at the back. They're detailed there.
Okay, at that level, honorable members, I think we have come to the end of this session. We may, members are requested to remain behind. I see there are still some local issues to deal with. Thank you very much, Deputy.